and KPFK AUTO.
You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake.
Is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And this is what feminism can sound like.
It is hard to find your community. Like, I always say that, like, it's hard to find your people. And I don't know why, but somehow romance is like a great way to find your people.
My name's Elise Staples. So this is a meeting of the East Bay Romance Readers. We are a romance book club on meetup.com. And this is our monthly get together and chat about one particular book.
We're going to be talking about romance novels, which once upon a time I used to look down on because I thought they weren't real literature.
Yeah, right? The internalized misogyny that somehow, like, it's not okay to like sexy things and be out about it.
I don't know why we became obsessed with this idea that love is not worthy of reading about or spending time thinking about. It's okay to think about nuclear war in Russia in your book or serial killers, which it is. All of that is okay.
The thing is, romance can actually be such a hopeful and political genre, full of love and potential.
They don't want us to read it and then be like, wait a minute, I could have a guy like that?
Emotionally available? So concerned about my needs and my pleasure?
Yeah.
What I like to tell people is that there's a book and a genre for everybody, and sometimes it's just finding the one that works for you. And if you haven't tried romance because you think you know what it is, I think you'd be really surprised at what modern romance does and who it's being written by and who it's being targeted to and just like the things it can accomplish from a literary standpoint. And if you're real lucky, there's going to be some really great sex in the middle. So,
oh yeah, and there's also a lot of great sex in romance novels. But even though romance novels can be radical and modern, the genre also has some problems.
I know when the whole RWA thing happened, like, we talked about it a little bit. I don't know if everybody knows what happened in their whole... They got called out pretty heavily for how they...
Unfortunately, in the last couple of years, we've seen the reports, we've seen the Ripped Bodice doing their research and looking at how many authors of color are being represented, who's getting picked to publish books, who's getting picked up and getting these contracts. And it's not often the people of color. There was this idea that if you have a book about a Black person and you put them on the cover, that's urban fiction. That goes in a separate category. There is this idea that the, like, white heteronormative story is the only one that's really worth reading. And that's not true.
We're going to spend today looking into the question of race in romance novels and really in the whole publishing industry because of this huge scandal that erupted within the Romance Writers of America, which is this isolated corner of the writing world that actually has a lot to say about race in the United States.
I'm really glad to see that it's changing. I'm making an active effort in my book club to select books that are more by more diverse authors because they're out there and they write fantastic stuff. And it's really worth reading and it's such an authentic experience that the first time I started seeing myself reflected in a book as a Black woman, it was just magical. I was like, oh my gosh, she's got curly hair and she puts it up in a scarf at night. And I can relate to that. And, you know, seeing myself represented, it's like indescribably wonderful.
So this story actually begins in August of 2019. There was this kind of astonishingly dramatic sort of meltdown that happened in the Romance Writers of America, so much so that it just spilled out of the little romance corner of the internet to sort of anyone who was interested in the media suddenly saw this happening.
That's Constance Grady. She's the senior culture reporter for Vox, and she's going to lead us through the meltdown at the RWA, or the Romance Writers of America.
It concerns Courtney Milan, who is a very beloved romance novelist. She is also a former lawyer, and she was placed on the ethics committee of RWA.
Oh, and as a side note, The Romance Writers of America has been around since 1980 as a professional organization, and it's really important if you want to become a successful novelist.
Its job is to offer romance writers community, support, and advocacy. A lot of people look down on romance novels and think they're kind of silly and not worth taking seriously. And RWA is a place where people can go and say, okay, this is a legitimate form of art, and it is also an extremely big business, and we are going to take it seriously, and we're going to take you seriously for your interest in it.
So Courtney Milan was on the ethics committee for the RWA, and she started making some personal tweets in August of 2019 about other members of the romance community.
A history of questionable things they had said and done concerning race. I'll note here that Courtney Milan is of Asian descent, and the other romance writers she was talking about were all white. One of them had liked multiple tweets that were sort of white supremacist adjacent, you might say. And then one of her colleagues at the small romance press where she worked had written a historical romance novel in which Chinese women characters appear, and they are described as, I'm going to quote directly here, demure and quiet as our mothers have trained us to be.
Of course, Courtney Milan, as an Asian woman, felt personally offended by that description and the kind of racist tropes around Asian women which that passage is drawing from.
So she is tweeting out a critique of these figures in the romance community and their role as sort of institutional gatekeepers. You know, one of these figures had been the romance buyer for Borders for years and years, when Borders was one of the biggest booksellers in the country.
They also run some major presses. So the people Courtney Milan is tweeting about are people who have a lot of influence in terms of whose work gets published and sold, which the romance writing world, like most of the publishing world, is a very white industry.
And so Courtney Milan is making this sort of structural critique of the romance community as a community where the gatekeepers may have some unexamined racial prejudices, and that affects whose stories get told.
So far, the story isn't that unusual, because for a while now, people have started to use social media to talk about issues like race and sexism, especially within organizations that aren't listening to them otherwise. But then things get a little wilder.
The people she's talking about do not care for this at all. So Catherine Lynn Davis, who files a complaint against Courtney Milan with RWA, so does Suzanne Tisdale, who is running the press under discussion, so does Catherine Lynn Davis. They are saying that they have lost work because of these tweets, that she is being racist against them as white people. Suzanne Tisdale says at one point that putting Courtney Milan on the ethics committee is akin to putting a neo-Nazi in charge of a UN human rights committee. This apparently causes a lot of turmoil within RWA.
It also causes a lot of turmoil on the internet, as you can imagine. And the RWA itself, well, it didn't respond in the best way. And we're going to come back to everything that went down at the RWA in a second. But first, just what's up with romance novels? I bet some of you out there are romance fans. Maybe some of you read it in secret, and I bet others have never tried it because of its reputation. Romance was traditionally seen as women's literature. It was written by women, and it's all about women finding happiness. And anything that serves women primarily is seen as inferior. So a lot of people who read romance feel that they're looked down upon, and they try to hide the covers of their romance novels, you know, the bodice rippers, by holding them within another more traditional book. So I don't know, that man reading House of Leaves on the train might actually be reading Bridgerton. But even though people look down on romance, it might actually have something to teach us about happiness and emotional depth and the power of a love story.
I like fiction that you can read at a clip, that kind of the story just takes you along pretty quickly. But also I discovered that my mom is a closet romance enthusiast. And so I was kind of perusing her shelves and noticing like shelf after shelf of Judith McNaught and Lisa Claypass. And so I'd ask her for recommendation. I said, well, which one, you know, what do you think I would like? And she handed me a Lisa Claypass and I was hooked.
So that's Reagan Jackson. She is herself a writer and she's the co-executive director of a nonprofit called Young Women Empowered. And she's also a huge romance fan.
That is not what I would think of Black feminist reading material, white women in distress in sexually compromising positions. That doesn't, it just kind of doesn't really like jive with my worldview. And yet what I found is some of the stories were just really interesting and really good. I feel like with romance as a genre, even if if the story is deep and rich and whatever, there's still this kind of levity to it. And I think part of it maybe is just the promise of a happy ending that you don't really get in literature.
Reagan immediately fell in love with romance novels, but then she discovered the world of romance written by people of color, especially romance written by Black women.
Oh, it's just so much more relatable to me. Like, I don't know. Have I ever tried on a corset? Sure. But that's not my everyday reality. It's like, you know, going from one fabulous estate to the next on the hunt for a husband. Like, that's not super relatable to me in my life and where I'm at. Versus, you know, some of the stories that I've read, like by Talia Hibbert, is a sequel to, well, not a sequel, but it's a companion book to Chloe Brown Gets a Life, is Danny Brown Takes a Hint. And it's Danny is Chloe's sister. And she is a Black feminist academic who ends up in a relationship with a Pakistani rugby player. I'm trying to think of any book that I've read that wasn't nonfiction where there's a Black feminist woman that gets to have a romance. I think we get to have a movement. I think we get to have a protest or contribute, you know, to everybody else's well-being in their life. But it is very rare that we are fed and nurtured and nourished.
You know, when I was talking to Reagan, I hadn't really paid that much attention to how much of popular culture, meaning movies, for example, and television, was dedicated to making women, and particularly Black women, suffer. But it's kind of incredible if you think about it. There are a lot of depictions of rape, of murder, of beatings and injustice and just misery. And that was something a lot of people I talked to said when I asked them about why they loved romance novels. They said that for them, they were just tired of seeing people suffer. And that in this political climate, seeing people fall in love instead and have a happy ending felt radical. It felt fulfilling and life-changing.
That book, honestly, like in some ways, kind of changed my life because it gave me permission to feel like I deserve more. I feel like the way that girls and women, and especially Black women, have been socialized is to always put everyone first. If you ever go to any type of event, like community event, and you see that it's run by Black women, you might notice that they are the last to eat. They've made all the food. They've made provisions for elders, made sure that everyone has a seat at the table and are most likely standing somewhere in a corner in uncomfortable shoes, looking fabulous. No one's asking them how they are. No one is bringing them a cup of water or bringing them any of the food that they have so lovingly prepared. And I think when you see that enough, that becomes kind of just an internalized thing, your role as a human being, it feels like you're there for the purpose of serving others. So to read a narrative, to read a story where that's actually acknowledged, and this person, like, spoiler alert, meets a person who can really see how like great and incredible she is and then offer compassion and care. I needed to see that. I need to read that story over and over again. I need to read 9 more stories just like it, because it's nourishing.
So let's come back to what was happening with the RWA. After the Twitter explosion in 2019, the RWA decided it was time to take action.
So it's unclear exactly what happens behind RWA closed doors after this point, after these complaints come in. There are a lot of conflicting stories and a lot of rumors.
What we do know is that on December 23rd, right before Christmas, the RWA suspends Courtney Milan, who was the Asian woman who had posted on Twitter about the racism she had seen in her colleague's work. And
she has been issued a lifetime ban to prevent her from assuming a leadership role in RWA ever again. It is a very, very strict response, and it causes this enormous backlash. What a lot of people end up arguing is that this is an attempt by an older, more conservative, whiter wing of Romancelandia to sort of grab control back of this community now that they are facing a critique from younger, more progressive writers, writers of color, queer writers, and who have sort of managed to gain enough of a foothold in RWA to finally have a little bit of institutional power and make their critique actually land.
This lifetime ban and suspension of Courtney Milan causes a dramatic backlash online.
You get all kinds of people issuing public statements in support of Courtney Milan, including major, major romance authors, romance literary agents, romance critics, local chapters of RWA, the International Association for the Study of Popular Romance cuts its ties with RWA, so does Bookstore Romance Day. So just one day later, December 24th, Christmas Eve, there's an emergency board meeting and the board reverses its decision and they reinstate Courtney Milan.
But at this point, the damage has been done and other authors begin posting about their experiences with the RWA.
So you get things like members of color sharing stories about microaggressions they've experienced at RWA meetings. There are some people saying that local chapters are paying Black speakers less than they pay white speakers. Some people are saying that queer authors aren't being offered help from RWA after they register professional complaints, which that is the literal reason that this organization exists, right? To advocate for its members professionally.
And we should spend some time talking about these grievances that people begin to share, because although the public eruption around race happened in 2019, authors who weren't white or straight had always had difficult experiences with the organization. For example, the RWA had once faced some backlash around queerness.
This was an issue in 2005. This is at the time that the country is spending a lot of time debating same-sex marriage. RWA creates a poll and asks members whether they would consider defining the genre as one characterized by love stories between one man and one woman. So queer love stories would not be allowed, poly love stories would not be allowed.
And creature love stories, which is a romance between a woman and a male animal, for example, that probably would have been fine. But two women falling in love? No.
And that was a huge, huge controversy. This definition was never formally adopted into the bylaws, but the fact that it was even up for debate kind of became a real sticking point for a lot of the queer community.
And of course, the RWA has also had a problem with race for a long time. And one place accusations of racism turn up a lot is at the annual awards put on by the RWA called the RITAs.
They're basically the most prestigious award in the community, and they're kind of the splashiest thing that RWA is responsible for every year. Like, they're doing other work. They're doing advocacy and membership support. But the thing that everyone remembers is you go to the annual conference, you put on a fancy dress, and you go to the RITA Awards.
It's like the Oscars for romance novelists. It's a really big deal. And between 2007 and 2017, of all of the authors who became finalists for the RITAs, less than 0.5% of them were Black.
And no Black author had ever won a RITA until 2019.
But the people who are nominated are just part of the problem. There's also the content of the books.
Probably the most controversial example was in 2014. This novel titled For Such a Time was nominated for two RITAs. It is about a romance between a Nazi officer and a concentration camp prisoner who is half Jewish. And in the end, the heroine reforms the hero, but only after converting to Christianity.
Ooh, yeah, you heard that right. That's pretty bad. There was a lot of concern from members about how books with such problematic love stories were even getting nominated for awards. And individual authors of color, some of whom did manage to get recognition from the RWA for their work, have also had really bad experiences.
One person I talked to was this novelist, Nina Malone, who described being at her first RWA convention back in 2019, which was the year that for the first time there were authors of color winning readas. And she describes being in the reception and overhearing this group of white women talking about the awards, and one of them, after two women of color have won awards, goes, "Oh, I didn't know that we needed two tokens." That was really hard for her to hear, and part of why she chose not to renew her membership with RWA after that.
In fact, the constant racist aggressions at the awards had already generated an online campaign long before Courtney Milan began tweeting about her complaints.
You start seeing this hashtag campaign, Rita's So White, kind of patterned after the Oscars So White Twitter campaign. And you do start to see RWA respond by seeming to try to become more inclusive and a little less retrograde in its romantic tastes. A lot more members of color are getting recruited to the board. And for a lot of people, it seemed like a big victory for the progressive wing of RWA when Courtney Milan joins the board in 2015, and she wins a service award in 2019. And there's diversity training happening within the judging committee for RWA. In 2019, three authors of color win awards. You know, it's starting to seem like, okay, people are really trying, they're putting in some effort. And then comes this big meltdown in 2019.
And we're going to get back to the end of the RWA saga in a bit, but before we do, I wanted to look into the history of romance novels and issues of race. And for that, I found an academic who studies romance.
My name is Jayashree Kamble. I'm a professor of English at LaGuardia Community College in the City University of New York. And my main area of research is popular romance novels. I also study romance in other media, like Indian cinema and in television.
Professor Kamble told me that for a literary genre, romance is kind of young.
It's just about over 100 years old. So we trace its history to a publishing firm called Mills and Boone in the UK. And then the subsequent spread of it across the globe, initially in the former colonies of the British Empire. After a while, the North American distributor of the books, which was a small company named Harlequin in Canada, is the one that actually steps in and becomes well-known over the world, especially in North America, as the romance novel. So these are typically fairly small books, about 180 pages, and the trajectory of the plot is the initial potential conflict between a man and a woman, cis man, cis woman, and their ability to overcome those conflicts and come together in, for most of the life of the genre, in holy matrimony, essentially.
Some people consider books like Jane Eyre to be early romance novels, and as you can probably figure out, because is coming from Victorian England and spreading out through the colonies, romance upheld a particular set of cultural beliefs.
The ideological framework is certainly coming out of a Christian tradition, you know, notions of purity, especially when it comes to sexual behaviors, and what then finally allows those things to be anointed into a particular version of couplehood and then the propagation of the family.
That Christian tradition still has a huge influence over much of the romance industry. But romance novels have shifted a lot. There are romance novels that are pornographic. There are romance novels about trans love, queer love, fat disabled people falling in love, polyamorous love stories. The genre is really diverse, and that's partially the influence of who's reading romance novels now.
The industry is always interested in finding audiences. as soon as anybody identifies a consumer demographic, capitalism being what it is, would like to fill that niche, right? So in that sense, as much of a Marxist as I am, I imagine capitalism can have its uses.
And here's the other super interesting thing about the history of the romance industry. It's the most democratic of all the literary arts. The industry actually encourages its readers to become authors and to write.
Romance has, as long as I can remember it, had that tradition. And a romance publishers very actively cultivated that. In the backs of the books, especially if you look at Mills and Boone, Harlequin from the 60s, there are inserts and there are things in the back of the book saying, do you think you can write a romance? Send us your manuscript. Or the Romance Writers of America was also founded as a professional organization to help those readers, by and large, who thought, oh, I love reading this. I also think I have a story in me that I could tell in the same format.
Romance is also one of the few genres that openly accepts and celebrates self-publishing or publishing online and in different formats. And this openness to new authors and new formats has allowed experimentation and representation to really flourish in the romance industry.
In fact, just recently, I was reading what falls into the sci-fi genre of romance, and it's a piece by author Anna Gire, and it's called Strange Love, and it's a human meets other terrestrial. And I was really taken aback and pleased by how well it managed to use the idea of the extraterrestrial to explore the notions of queerness and different bodies and what it means to have an erotic connection to someone whose body does not fit any of your previous understandings of what your romantic partner and sexual partner could be. So people are doing very interesting things by fusing together different kinds of genres underneath the major plot of the romance.
That history is so interesting to me, and it explains a lot about the current race debate within the RWA. Because on the one hand, you have this very open, democratic art form that says, please join us, you can also write, and we will publish you. And on the other hand, it's steeped in this white, Victorian, Christian tradition, which uses love stories to push an idea of womanhood and virtue. I just don't think you see that combination in many other art forms, and it might be why the race debate within the RWA is especially challenging. So, when we left off, the RWA had reinstated Courtney Milan, but
at this point, half of the board is resigning in protest. There are stories leaking that Courtney Milan's suspension was decided in the first place in this kind of secret backroom deal that the rest of the board didn't actually know about. The RWA president, Damon Swade, is resigning. He has only been in office for 2 weeks at this point. And RWA has kind of left a skeleton of itself, right? It has only half a board and no president.
And despite the public outrage and the fact that the organization almost fell apart, the RWA decided it wanted to try and rebuild from the ground up.
So they call off the Ritas. They hire an outside firm that is going to audit their practices, and they hire a diversity consultant that can restructure their award system. And then finally, in February, what is left of the board resigns. An interim board comes in, and they say that in the 5 months they have left before they get a new permanent board, they are going to try to completely overhaul RWA. And all of this is going to be happening in the middle of a pandemic.
America. What's going on, Los Angeles? My name is Kat Brooks. I'm a boots on the ground organizer, artist, abolitionist, and the host of Law and Disorder. Born at KPFA in the Bay 3 years ago, L&D seeks to be a partner in movement by making space and place for the freedom fighters locked out of mainstream media, artists using their work as active resistance, and connecting with our brothers and sisters on the other side of the walls. You can tune in for that fire Monday through Thursdays at 8 a.m. on 90.7 FM or online at kpfk.org.
It's one thing to love public radio, but it's a special thing to support it. Consider this. If you've got a car you don't need anymore, or you've got one that is simply too expensive to repair, arrange to donate it to KPFK. It's easy for you, pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thanks in advance, and here is how to get started. Go to kpfk.org/cars or call 877-573-5288. That is 1-877-KPFK-AUTO. And learn more.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
I'm Anita Johnson. Ever since the first Africans were brought to North America on cargo ships, Black women have helped build this country, now known as the United States of America. While Black women have played a critical role in the development of our nation, their stories, our stories, have been overlooked and intentionally left out of history books. In the new book, A Black Woman's History of the United States, historians Dr. Dinah Rami Berry and Dr. Callie Nicole Gross honor the many significant contributions of Black women who have worked tirelessly to build this country and fight for social justice in the face of racism and sexism. Today, we'll learn about some of these amazing women.
There was no way we could write a book and not feature Shirley Chisholm. Mm-hmm. Unbought and unbossed.
What I like about her is her speech when she does the acceptance speech. Or when she says that she's going to be the nominee, she's running for president. She makes that announcement. And she says, I'm not the candidate for Black America, although I'm Black. I'm not the candidate for the women's America, although I'm a woman. I'm a candidate. There's another sentence. And then she says, I'm the candidate for the people of America. And it's just a really powerful moment. And it just reminds me of the level of activism. When we look at Black women last year on the campaign trail, we look at the number of Black women that were being considered for the vice presidency, and we have a Black and South Asian woman now, Vice President Harris. So that you just think about that, and I think about Shirley Chisholm sort of paving the way for these contemporary women. And so we had to include her in here.
That's Dr. Dinah Rami Berry. She, along with Dinah Rami Berry, joined KPFA's moderator, Sabrina Jacobs, for an insightful conversation about the Black women activists, trailblazers, and others who have left a notable mark on this country. Dr. Callie Nicole Gross.
So in thinking about how we're going to do this, right? Well, on one hand, we know that Black women and Black women's experiences, they're not a monolith, right? And we wanted to make sure that we talked about all kinds of Black women, from enslaved women to free women, women in rural parts of the country, women from the South, in urban areas, the North, Midwest, West Coast, you name it, all walks of life. But in spite of all of their differences, there are a number of themes that seem to impact Black women's experiences in broadly. And so we decided that this would also be some of the organizing principles for the book. I mean, you see them here laid out. Travel, motion, and migration is a huge aspect of Black women's experiences, whether that's forced migration, whether Black women chose, elected to leave, but, you know, I say voting with their feet, right? Taking phase, you know, violence is obviously an inescapable aspect of Black womanhood. We looked at that in a lot of ways, certainly physical violence, sexual violence, but also thinking too about representational violence, the ways that Black women are caricatured and ridiculed, also the violence of poverty. The other theme we worked on was certainly activism is a central facet. From the first sister who, you know, chose to come, you know, and on an exploration, which Dinah will talk more about, right until today, Black women have been demanding justice, have been decrying inequity, and are fierce advocates and will stand up and organize. Labor and entrepreneurship are also vital aspects. And again, we try to approach that broadly, thinking about their experiences with respect to enslavement, but also ways that they branched out and tried to cultivate their own careers to escape agricultural labor and domestic service and other kinds of labor that was exploitative even after enslavement. The other big sort of change, not change, but one of the other streams that we really wanted to incorporate is looking at criminalization and incarceration. I think a lot of times when we think about these issues around justice and mass incarceration, we tend to approach this as something that uniquely happens to Black men. And one of the things that we find in history is that Black women were actually more disproportionately overrepresented in the justice system than Black men. And that's something that begins in the North, almost from the country's founding, when they gradually, you know, phase out enslavement. Mm-hmm. And then throughout the whole country, including the South, once we have the Civil War. So that was a key piece to also sort of really tease out too, to see how deeply embedded these biases and misogynoir really is in the country. But at the same time, you know, we didn't want to put together a history that would be sort of this one-sided kind of slog through violence and terror and tyranny. We also wanted to capture Black women's vibrancy, that spirit, the passion that keeps folks going. So we also focused on art, performance, creativity. And this is all throughout the book, throughout all these different aspects of history. So not just as soon as we get to like 1975, or all of a sudden we're talking about artists or something. No, artists are in the antebellum period. They are in the late 19th century, the early 20th century, you know, creativity, performance, all these things to just sort of highlight the ways that people indulge and express themselves and also a love for their Black womanhood. And then, of course, in thinking about sex and sexuality, we wanted to explore pleasure, right? That we talk a lot about sex and violence and terror and these things that happen to Black women. We know a lot about Black women's bodies as victimized bodies, but we also wanted to explore Black womanhood's experience with respect to sexuality and the erotic, and also too with different sexual identities. So we took pains to make sure that we represented the experiences of Black queer women, and again, throughout history. So we don't wait until we get into the 70s to start talking about Black lesbians. We talk about Black queer experiences in the antebellum period, the late 19th century, the 20th century, right up to. So these are sort of the central themes that we structure the book around and what we sort of took pains to accomplish.
And Dinah, Dr. Avery, would you like to go ahead and answer? We've already got a question here. So.
Yeah. So we had a question that from Lavinia Harrison asking, why is family or motherhood not included as a central theme? It's actually not listed as a central theme, but it is absolutely a theme that is throughout the entire book. And one of the things that we will talk about is all of the mothers that we write about in the book that really did phenomenal things under extreme duress and stress. The women that raised children after being the product of rape during slavery. The women and mothers like Mamie Till Mobley, who had the open casket for her son, Emmett Till, which we'll talk about. And we talk about the mothers of the conjoined twins, Millie and Christine McCoy. So mothers are there. We just didn't have it listed as a theme, but there's no way when you read the book that you'll see that motherhood and family is absolutely a central theme. We just used the ones that Dr. Gross was talking about. That was how we sort of framed the argument. We knew we needed to talk about those. We try to talk about each of those in every chapter, and motherhood was just naturally there. So hopefully that answers your question. And I don't know if you wanted to add to that, Kelly, or anything.
No, I mean, I would agree. I think that is, in some respects, right. It was sort of naturally there and throughout. And it comes and occurs through all the stories and many, many of the chapters.
And one thing I always say, because my area of expertise is slavery, is that, you know, not all women, even in the post-slavery era, even today, not all women choose to be mothers, not all women want to be mothers. And so we always leave a space for that as well. Or some women were forced to be mothers and not really, you know, and having to raise children that they struggled with raising. So there's that, when we talk about motherhood, we have to look at all the complexities of it, and some of the challenges there. So I want to jump to Isabel de Overa, who opens up the first chapter. And she is a figure who we did about a year of research on to find out who this woman was. We were trying to figure out, where do we start this book? Where do we start in 1619 with the first ship that came, that we talk about all the time, that now lots of people know about? Or do we go a little bit earlier? Are there women of African descent that were here earlier? And if so, where were they? What were they doing? What are their stories? Isabel de Overa is one such woman who we were very happy to write about, and other scholars have written about her as well. She was a woman of both African and Indian descent. She lived in Mexico, and she wanted to go on an expedition to travel with a number of other explorers that were going into what now is, it was New Spain. It's called New Spain, but it's present day New Mexico. And she had to file a petition with the local government, and she had to then have witnesses to testify to whom she was and that she was valid, and that they could validate her going. And she was asking and demanding and requesting a piece of paper to show that she was a free woman and that she was bound neither by marriage nor slavery, and that she could go on this expedition and that people would not bother her. And she wanted to have this documentation to carry with her as sort of that authentication paperwork so that no one would bother her, because she knew that people would be disturbed, as she says, disturbed by her being a mulatta. So that's her. And at the end, she says, you know, I'm going on an expedition and have reason to fear that I may be annoyed. I may be annoyed by some individual since I am a mulatta. I demand justice. And as Dr. Gross was saying a few minutes ago, Black women came to this country demanding justice before 1619. And that was really important for us to start with that time period and to start with a woman who was free, to show that Black people did not just come to this country enslaved, that they had lived in freedom and in spaces of freedom in all parts of the world, and that their captivity brought them to the United States as enslaved people, but not everybody came that way. So that was really important for us to start off with Isabel de Overa.
Dr. Dinah Rami Berry.
So when we go into the next section, this is more familiar. This is really where, if you've taken an African-American history class, this is where the textbooks often begin. They begin often in 1619. We've been hearing a lot about it over the last year because of the anniversary, the past anniversary or commemoration of the first arrival of 20 odd, the quote was 20 odd Negroes. So we looked at the women and one woman that was on that particular ship or those ships, and that was Angela. And we really went back to understand, like, where did she come from? What community did she live in? What was her capture like? What was her experience before she landed? Because most of what we know and most of what we teach is after the landing. But there's such a larger history of women on slave ships. And I want to just read a little section, just a quick section about what it might be like to be captured from the first chapter. Consider for a moment that the particular trauma of forced captivity for women. African girls and women might have been tended to children, or engaged in other responsibilities in their villages with family and with friends, when suddenly someone with a sackcloth on their head put a sackcloth on their heads and chains on their feet. They were violently taken and forced to walk to places that they did not know existed. When they arrived, some of them saw bodies of water that seemed to have no end. Even more frightening was the sight of their captors. This may have been the first time they saw people with white skin. Who were they? Ghosts? Cannibals? Evil spirits? Were their captors European or African? How did women make sense of the process of what was happening, or did they process what was happening? In the midst of all of this confusion, they were forced to walk in quote unquote slave coffles, chained by neck or ankles to their captives, other captives, many whom did not speak the same language, despite the commonality of their skin tone. Those being transported, they may not have been from the same community. African people came from thousands of different ethnicities and spoke a variety of languages. Barefoot and sometimes naked, they were put into holding facilities with cold concrete floors and walls that did not have windows, a suffocating ventilation system. Bodily fluids such as vomit, blood, urine, and feces caked the floor and the walls, and the stench was overwhelming. Speaking sounds of distraught mothers, daughters, aunties, grandmothers, infants, moaning, crying, and screaming were ear-piercing and haunting. This was not a place anyone chose to visit nor cared to remember. It was a place that they all wanted to forget. So that is just a passage of some of the more difficult passages of the book. We actually, if you remember, we struggled. Some of our early openings were a little bit too heavy. And we had to back up. We want people to read the book, but there are some pieces in here and there's sections in here that are challenging. If you haven't read about the institution of slavery, if you don't know much about Black women's experience with incarceration, some of those sections are going to be challenging for the reader. But there's also, as Callie was saying, there's joy. There's moments of just great creativity and strength. So the whole gamut is in this book. You go to the next, maybe. So I'm going to say a few more things and then we'll shift gears. But the next section we move into, because we kind of go chronologically. So now we're moving into a period in the third chapter where we're talking about Black women and independence. And the main point of this chapter is to show that Black women were fighting for independence from day one. Just as we said with Isabel de Oliveira, they filed for petitions and suits. They went to court. They ran away. They resisted. They did all kinds of things. So that's really the main point. And we've tried to identify how Black women experienced the American Revolution.
Dr. Callie Nicole Gross.
So we moved through the chapters and get to the Civil War, the end of Civil War. We also talked about Black women's experiences after the Civil War. I don't know if this passage is too long. No, I think you can go. Chapter 6 is called Frances's Sex, The Dawning of the Black Woman's Era, 1876 to 1915. And there's a quote that says, "None of your damn business." It's Frances Thompson. So in 1876, Frances Thompson, a formerly enslaved Black woman, was arrested in Memphis, Tennessee, and fined $50. She had migrated to the area about a decade earlier at a time maybe full of hope and excitement as she began her new life as a free woman in the city. She made friends and lived in a booming Black community. She liked nice dresses, especially those in bright colors. In 1866, she would survive the extraordinary violence that decimated her neighborhood. Just a year after emancipation, Frances would testify before a congressional committee. One of five Black women to tell their stories that day, Frances, who relied on crutches because of a foot malady, described how she had been robbed and gang raped by a group of white men, at least two policemen among them. The men burst into the home she shared with another Black woman, Lucy Smith, and savaged them both. As Frances testified, they drew their pistols and said they would shoot us and fire the house if we did not let them have their way with us. The Memphis riots, sparked in part by white rage at Black Union soldiers, claimed over 40 African-American lives, as well as 91 homes, 4 churches, and 12 schools, the latter all set ablaze. Untold numbers of Black women and girls likely suffered the same fate as had Frances. But Frances and the other women followed in the footsteps of Black women who reported soldiers' crimes during the Civil War. Specifically, they went on record to state unequivocally that they did not consent. And I want to pause here for a minute because I really, really stretch out and thinking about some of the themes that we talked about and the readings that Diana shared also. We mark this moment where Black women are really laying claim to themselves and their own bodies for the first time as citizens in the country. And a key aspect of that for Black women was the power to say that they did not consent, because up until that point, it was not a crime to rape a Black woman or a Black girl. And that was true for basically either Black or white men. So this was sort of monumental for them to have done that. All right, so I'm just going to finish up. And I promise you, too, it is not much longer. All right, the published congressional report laid bare white's cruelties. And locally, Frances Thompson became persona non grata. For the next decade, she would endure police harassment, accused of everything from distributing hoodoo bags and telling fortunes to being responsible for, quote, infamous traffic as a procuress and keeper of one of the vilest dens in the city, end quote. And there were more serious allegations. According to the Memphis Public Ledger, Frances had been, quote, arrested several times on suspicion of being a man, and notorious lewdness, but always managed to escape the clutches of the law, end quote. However, in July of 1876, she did not get away. Though Frances maintained that she was, quote, of double sex, a local white doctor, doubtful of her claims, had her arrested. And after subjecting her to a series of invasive examinations by four physicians, they told authorities that her true sex was male. What did these examinations mean for Frances? One wonders how she coped with such violations. Frances had lived at least 20 years as a woman, donning ladies' hats and gingham overskirts with petticoats, attire fashionable for her day. The finding that her sex was male forced her into male clothes, men's clothes, and onto a male chain gang. Whereas Frances had maintained a smooth face in custody, authorities denied her the ability to shave. And as the day's doings noted, quote, a thick black beard is coming out all over his face to his great disgust, end quote. As a free woman, Frances had cleaved out a life for herself, weathering seasons that might find her almost in rags or draped in the finest and loud colored toggery. Behind bars, she never suffered her fight, answering rude questions about her gender by responding, quote, none of your damn business. And so these are the kinds of stories and histories. When we talked about writing a Black woman's history for the 21st century, this to me is another great example of what that means. And so she is a part of this continuum of Black women. Another famous one, Mary Church Terrell, certainly also, you know, a tremendous figure, you know, fighting for suffrage and criminal justice. But we didn't only sort of focus on these folks. We also talked about other kinds of Black women like Augusta Savage, who's another one of my favorite. She was an artist, a sculptress, a Black nationalist. She, you know, she founded a free art school in New York because she also wanted to sort of democratize the process. She went abroad on a fellowship and studied in France. You know, her husband was a Garveyite. One of her second ex-husband was a Garveyite. But she also was a kind of a mover and shaker. You know, she was married and had a child initially very young. You know, then she shed her husband and moved up north and, you know, started referring to her daughter as her sister, started lying about her age, saying she was a decade younger and hanging out with these Harlem Renaissance luminaries and on the jazz scene. So, you know, she was, right. So we talk also about Frances and what art meant to her. Mm-hmm. But we also did want to, again, feature the experiences of everyday women. And so we also talk about women who were working as domestics or working as sharecroppers in rural parts of the country, how they managed to sort of fight through, especially during the Depression. And again, always working to sort of feature Black women's voices whenever we can. And just learned so much too in the process about kind of Black women's experiences. And also even just sort of the labor of doing that work. I mean, some of the stories are, you know, pretty sad and harrowing. And so it was also important just to check in to figure out how to kind of mediate that, right? Tell those stories and come back from it. But again, we try to talk about all types of women. So even women who desegregate the armed forces, who are among the first to serve. And we also definitely, this is back to sort of the question I think where someone had raised about mothers. We talk a lot about Black women's experiences in the community in their own way, but also as freedom fighters. And we spend a lot of time talking about women like Mamie Till, Emmett Till's mother, because everyone knows about Emmett Till, but we don't really talk about, you know, Mamie, if she hadn't made this courageous decision. You know, to open up this coffin, we would not know his story. He wouldn't have been that spark, right? That sort of set the, you know, the civil rights movement kind of ablaze. And the thing is that when we study her and talk about her, we realize it was so much more than just making a decision to open that coffin. It was fighting to even reclaim his body from the, you know, officials in the South, because they were intent upon trying to cover it up and bury it. You know, she had to do all of this networking and, you know, mobilizing local officials in Chicago. So you think about when we see these instances of young people murdered violently by racists, and how the mothers, the families hardly get a moment to grieve, right, before they have to go to battle to try to get justice. She's one of these very, very early examples of that. So we spend a lot of time talking about Mamie and quoting her and using her words as much as possible. We also quote the parents of the four little girls who died in the church bombing in 1963 in Birmingham. Their mothers also talking about the justice, the pain, the sorrow of that loss.
A virtual question was presented to Dr. Kylie Nicole Gross and Dr. Dinah Ramey Berry. The question, Black women's suffrage and negotiating racism of the white women's movement, was that covered in the book?
I mean, we definitely talk about the ways that Black women tried to organize with white women's suffragists, the racism that they encounter. But also, I mean, one of the things that, you know, I love about that our history is that, you know, Black women aren't daunted by these things, right? You know, they know that bias is there and that these alliances are shaky, that white supremacy ultimately, you know, is going to be a dividing issue for them. So they continue to network and organize their own organizations and clubs. Black women organize voter registration drives. They, you know, collected testimonies and worked with politicians to try to change legislation when it was clear that Black people, once they did get the right to vote, were having their votes, you know, being denied. They fundraised for various candidates, took them around to churches. I mean, you name it. So Black women have championed the right to vote, you know, going as far back as we can remember. But I mean, one of the earliest proponents that most people know is certainly Sojourner Truth, right? Along with like Frederick Douglass. I mean, you know, Black women have always championed, you know, for these rights and issues. So the thing, I guess I just want to point out too, is some of it also for us was about not wanting to just have a history that's about sort of being in reference to what white folks or white women are doing also. Right? That we want to center Black women's voices and activism. It doesn't mean that we don't talk about, you know, their encounters with white racists. And also, you know, on those rare instances when they were able to work as allies. But at the end of the day, we were focusing on Black women in the narrative.
Absolutely. Dr. Berry, you want to add anything?
No, I think she said everything. I mean, there's an example that you probably have recently seen because of the suffrage movement, the 19th Amendment anniversary that just passed again.
Yes.
So you heard about Ida B. Wells being told she had to march in a segregated section of a suffrage parade, and she went right up in there with the other women and had their signs and went right to the front. So Black women don't always respond to the segregation or the disrespect or the marginalization that we're being put in or placed in. And that's so right. I would just say that that's an example of a Black woman saying, no, I'm not marching in the back of this parade. And we are going to come forward because we've been working on this in the trenches just as long as you have. So that's what I would say, is that we were there. And it's not just a book about we were there. It's also about how we were there and what we did when we were there.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
From the Watts Uprising to the present day, KPFK has been at the heartbeat of the struggle in Los Angeles. This February 2026, we mark a monumental milestone, the centennial of Black History Month. 100 years ago, Carter G. Woodson gave us a week to honor our past. Today, we celebrate a century of reclaiming our narrative. As we celebrate this centennial, we remember that Black history is not a sidebar. It is the foundation of the American story. You're invited to join us throughout February as we honor 100 years of truth-telling. I'm Stanley Clark, and this is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.